Welcome to another episode of A People's Theology. I'm the host of A People's Theology, Mason Meninga. In this episode, I am live at the 2024 Q Christian Fellowship Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I talk with Kathy Baldock and Ed Oxford about the 1946 mistranslation of homosexuality in the Bible. You can get connected with Kathy and Ed and their work in the links in the episode description. If you're a fan of A People's Theology, the easiest way to support the podcast is if you gave it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Tell me what you like about the podcast. Also, it would make my day if you would support my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Meninga. There are multiple tiers with great rewards, including papers I write and even being listed as a producer. Please enjoy more inspiring and liberating theology. Welcome, everyone. It's good to see you all. Are we recording, Mick? Are we good to go? Beautiful. Thank you so much. It's so great to see everyone's faces. How many of you have heard the podcast, A People's Theology? How many of you listen to the... Okay, a few of you. All right, great. Wonderful. Well, you can like and subscribe. It's everywhere you would listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you happen to like watching this face talk to other more beautiful faces, you can also watch the podcast episodes on YouTube. So if you just search, I'm sure you can find it somewhere easily on YouTube, but I've posted those conversations on YouTube as well. So thank you so much for coming and hanging out. This is so exciting. Today, we're going to have a conversation about the 1946 mistranslation that added the word homosexuality to the Bible. So I think on the little conference information piece, there was something about that there was a trigger warning around homophobia, transphobia. Obviously, those are some of the core pieces to why there was even a mistranslation. So just be aware that that might be a part of the conversation today. But today, we've got Kathy Baldock with us. And Kathy, you're an LGBTQ advocate. You have extensively researched around this specific topic of the 1946 mistranslation. And you also have a book coming out about it. And let me make sure that I've got the correct title. It's Forging a Sacred Weapon, How the Bible Became Anti-Gay. You have something important to say here.
Am I here?
Yeah.
I'm hoping that it will go to edits at the end of March and be out 2 or 3 months after that. And it's the kind of the supporting material for the documentary. So I think it probably overlaps, I would estimate, maybe 15%, because I really love history. So there's a lot of history in the book and a lot of great stories. I'm a storyteller.
If you weren't there this morning, you can tell she's a storyteller.
A lot of stories. So, yeah.
Lovely. We also have Ed Oxford, who also has extensively researched and has worked with Kathy on this 1946 mistranslation. Ed, you went to seminary, there's a lot of things to you. If you are one of those few people that have listened to the podcast, you know what question's about to come up. But I'm going to ask each one of you this. I'm going to first ask you, Ed. Who is Ed Oxford to Ed Oxford? And then I'm going to ask the same question to you, Kathy. So who is Ed Oxford to Ed Oxford?
Ed Oxford is this guy that just loves Jesus so much that it mattered more than life itself. And so just I think that's why I'm passionate about the research and passionate about what we've been doing, is because I just care so much. And I think that is who I am intrinsically, is just someone who just wants to love Jesus, to know him, and to make him known.
Love it. Love it. And Kathy, who's Kathy Baldock to Kathy Baldock?
I care about justice. I care about fair treatment and equality. And I care about academics, mm-hmm. And education and relationship, and in particular with a very close group of people. I highly value loyalty. Mm. And I care about academics is a big thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Love that. How many of you have seen the documentary 1946? And you know, it recently came out. We've got quite a few of you all. So a lot of you have seen it. They're going to be screening it right after this conversation. So we want to make sure we end at the hour because they've got to get to the screening. And you all should, if you're interested in this conversation, get over and watch the movie. But let's start talking about the movie, or not necessarily the movie, but specifically the story behind the movie. And that is this 1946 mistranslation. What led up to the word homosexuality being added to the Bible? Before we get to that 1946 translation, there's a whole history there of leading up to this mistranslation. So do you want to talk about what led up to eventually this happening in 1946?
Well, Kathy gives an amazing view of it as she brings in her time chart to kind of show us what was going on there. And so what I've done is collecting all of these old materials, old books, old Bibles spanning the last 500 years, because my question was, what was there before this word homosexual was there? I went to seminary and did not know that the word homosexual was not introduced into any Bible until 1946. I didn't dare ask questions about anything regarding homosexuality while I was in seminary because I was terrified. I didn't want my search engine to show that I was asking questions. So I just kept silent and just put my pillow in my head and cried at night and then made it through those decades. And so when I found out from going to a Kathy Baldock seminar that this word homosexual is not in the Bible until 1946, I just started soaking up information, collecting old commentaries, collecting old lexicons. We didn't have dictionaries until the 1480s. And so I collected, my oldest dictionary that I have right now is 1549. And so I collected old lexicons and things like that to say, how did they define this word, these words, and the words that were being used? What did they use before the word homosexual? The King James Version, which is the most populous for the vast majority of history of the translations, used the word abusers of themselves with mankind. So abuse was in the definition of this word. There was some kind of abuse going on. And we saw that abuse being taken out, and we see certain versions coming back and returning abuse to the translation. But what was there before? It was a lot of things. I found several commentaries that would talk about lazy people who just would not have the courage, not fight in war. And so I saw all the commentaries and the biblical archives that I've gone through and that I've collected show that we don't see a hint toward homosexuality until the late 1800s in these old commentaries. So what that tells us, and I'm looking at this period of the past 500 years, because that's when we have more information available to us. Prior to those past 500 years, what type of information did we have? And we can kind of go and look at that. But to see the transition and the transmission of how this word went throughout history is incredibly interesting for me. So,
and the reason this is a great partnership is because we look at things differently. Mm. So I look at history. So I knew that, you know, I know enough history to know what was the conversations around, and the word would have been homosexuals at the time. So what's the conversation in the early 20th century around the word homosexuals? And so you get curious, like, so my first question was, what could these people, that the people on the team, have known about homosexuals or homosexuality? They actually did the translation of that book in 1937. They finalized it in 1941. So we say 1946, but the work was done in the late 30s. So what did they know about homosexuals, homosexuality in the late 30s? Nothing. They had assumptions, and they were terrible assumptions. It wasn't quite a mental illness yet, but it was certainly some kind of perversion, and it was usually about seducing children. So that was associated with it. But if you go, as I went through a lot of the journals from different denominations, and I would try to word search either 1 Corinthians or homosexuals, nothing was showing up because they weren't using those verses to talk about this group of people. And as Ed said, these verses were used. There was one commentary I read of, like, how to preach on different verses. That verse was talking to people about, if you take the easy street, if you live on easy street, if you just, like, have a laissez-faire attitude about life, these are the things that are going to happen to you. So I knew that there was no theology around these verses, and there was no theology around homosexuality, because really, until the late 1950s, what pastors were told to do with homosexuals was to send them to a therapist because it was a mental health issue. They wouldn't use that word, but it was not a spiritual issue. So how does it all of a sudden go from there's these kinds of people to we're going to use the Bible to fix them? So I was fairly sure this was ideological and cultural and not theology. So that's where I was coming from. Different point of view, right? So he's coming from his seminary training, and I'm coming from historical context, and it caused us to ask the right questions.
So let's get to the moment where the mistranslation happens. You know, you're talking about there's something ideological that's going on here. So it wasn't just an oops that they had this word where it had been translated in different ways, and now all of a sudden we get the word homosexuality. You're saying it wasn't an oops, right? That there was some deliberate ideological motive behind this?
Hard to know. Because there's no support evidence from the time they were doing this to making this decision. This is why we went to Yale. We went to Yale, to those archives, to see the concurrent exchange, you know, somebody, the secretary of the meeting, saying, you know, what are we going to do with this? Oh, this is about the filthy, dirty homosexuals, you know, and that's what we're going to do. We were looking for, what we thought we were looking for, was notes from the time to document why they made this decision. And there were no notes. So that part was unbelievably dissatisfying. And I was very depressed as we were going through these things, and I wasn't finding evidence, because then that would say to me they weren't thinking about this theologically, and I could support this is ideological, cultural. But when you're doing research and you're trying to talk to people that are severely anti-LGBTQ, what Kathy Baldock thinks because she's read a lot is not important. You have to have evidence. So there was no evidence. There's no real hard evidence as to why they did it and to who did it. But this is why that letter from David is important, because in 1959 he writes to the team and he says, I think you're wrong. And the head of the team goes back. So now he's reaching back almost 20 years and saying, this is why we did it. But unfortunately, while he's reaching back, he's also inserting what they've learned in 20 years.
Yeah, definitely. And so we also would take it into context of knowing what did they understand about homosexuality? What could they have understood about homosexuality in the 30s and when they were in 40s when they were working in this translation? Knowing what they had available and what they didn't have available was very important to us, to kind of read in between the lines to kind of see what was going on. And also, the head of the translation team, Dr. Weigel, had a psychology degree in addition to several other degrees that he had. So he was very well versed in that type of thing. But what were they teaching people studying psychology in the 20s and before that when he actually went to school? So not a whole lot. So when we went into, or at least my opinion going into the archives was, I think these guys are nefarious and they're just looking for a way to kind of put the nail in the coffin on this homosexual issue. But we didn't find it that way when we went in the archives. It was amazing. You guys, so remember, we spent 5 days with limited hours because the archives are only open for certain hours of the day, and skipped bathroom breaks and dinner, lunch breaks and everything break just because we had so much to accomplish in a short amount of time. And one of the interesting things was when we got to the sections that had letters, where they had been receiving letters and writing back letters, Dr. Weigel would respond to every letter. One time there was a letter written on a napkin, and they sent the napkin in because they were probably asking a question about what's it, Hebrews 3:4 mean. And Dr. Weigel would type up a response and send it back to him. He's the dean of the Yale Divinity School. Busy guy, but he made time to make sure, which is excellent because it gives us a good amount of information about what he thought and how he processed information. And so it was so interesting because there were a couple letters that we found in that section. One where Dr. Weigel wrote to this church and he said, you have no women on your committee. How can you represent your whole church if it's only comprised of men? This is in the 30s, you guys, way ahead of his time. Another letter, he said, you have no black people on your committee, and you have black people in your community. You need to have black people in this committee to really represent. And we were like, wow, this guy is amazing. He's far. We liked him, and he was far ahead of his time. And this other letter I thought was so amazing. This lady wrote this letter to Dr. Weigel, and she says, Dr. Weigel, basically, you know, I'm a housewife. What can I do? I can't have an influence, but you're this big, powerful, famous dean. we have a problem in our community. Could you please do a favor and could you please write Congress? And she said, we have a poll tax. And a poll tax is where you had to pay a dollar. She said they have to pay a dollar to get a registration card to vote. And she said, we have poor people in our community and they can't afford it. If they have a dollar, they're going to spend it on food. This was the 1930s during the Great Depression. They're not going to spend their dollar on being able to vote. And she said, as a result, these poor people cannot be represented in Congress. So he wrote back to her, yes, ma'am, I will write Congress. And this is an injustice. We will definitely address this. And today we don't have a poll tax. Of course, they find other ways for voter suppression, but we don't have a poll tax today. So as a result, we were like enamored by these guys. Great sermons. We loved them. So we were learning about these translator people over the first 3 days until we discovered the reason that they made the decision. So it gave us a framework and kind of a background to these guys to make sure that we were looking at this information more appropriately.
I want to personally invite you to OrcCon 24 this July 8th through the 12th, 2024, at the Grand Targhee Resort in the Grand Teton Mountains of Wyoming. OrcCon is a time for you to meet and hear from some of your favorite open and relational thinkers, including Tom Ord, Trip Fuller, and Adam Clark. And if you register with the link in the episode description and use the promo code APeoplesTheology, you can receive $100 off of your ticket. I hope to see you there.
So in the documentary, there's a couple words that you really focus on, and I think they're both from 1 Corinthians. Malakoi is how you pronounce it. My Greek's not very good.
Malakoi.
And then the other one is arsenikoi, is how you pronounce it?
Arsenikoi.
Can you talk a little bit about what these two words mean? Obviously, again, they both are essentially combined to be translated into homosexuality, especially in the 1 Corinthians passage. Can you talk a little bit about what those two words really should have meant? Especially arsenikoi is really kind of a tricky word because we don't really see too many of that word being used very often other than when Paul uses it. But yeah, you want to talk a little bit about that history and just the historical context of those two words because those are very two key words in this documentary.
So since we don't have dictionaries until the 1480s, it makes this job very difficult. Otherwise, we could go to a first century dictionary. What did Paul mean in the first century when he used this word? And then we're good to go. So hence, we're all here today because they didn't have dictionaries 2,000 years ago. But at the end of the day, what happens is when we go and we look at the way we translate or get a dictionary that we can create from something that's 2,000 years ago, is we access other ancient documents, other ancient Greek or Hebrew documents. How is this word used in a sentence? And then we can deduce from that usage, a definition at that time. Because words change meaning over time, you guys. I have a 1941 dictionary, and the definition has 8 definitions for the word conversation. The third most populous definition in 1941 was sexual intercourse for the word conversation. So different meaning to let's go have a chat.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
But,
stop.
But that's just 1941 until now that word has changed. You can't find that in a modern dictionary today. So words change meaning over time. So we're talking about a different language, a different culture, and 2,000 years ago. So could that change over the last 2,000 years? And so we have to go to ancient documents to really access that meaning. So the word malakoi is used hundreds of times in ancient documents. So it's very easy to translate. The direct meaning, quick translation, is soft. So soft. Soft meaning what? It can actually refer to a soft cloth. It can refer to some person that's soft. And so if we look and go through ancient documents, we see if you're a coward and you're not willing to fight in that war, you're a soft person. You're a malakoi. Shame on you. You need to come. You need to be part of your community and support and be strong and help your community. So malakoi is also, we found some old definitions. Some people who would preen themselves, some men who would preen themselves to better their sexual exploits amongst women. So they would try to seduce other men's wives. So we have a lot of that going on. And then so we also see where there was one definition where if you like gourmet food, you are considered malakoi, so shame on you. But malakoi has several usages. So that word malakoi as soft. Then we have this other word, arsenokoitai. It's a compound word. Arseno means man. It's singular for man. And koitai is plural for bed. So one man, many beds is the a direct translation of that. But again, we have to go and look at the context. The first time we see the word arsenokoitai in all of history, the very first time, is when Paul writes it in 1 Corinthians 6:9. And then he puts that word again in 1 Timothy 1:10. So we see that word, arsenokoitai, twice in the entire New Testament. And so as a result, it's like, well, we don't have very many other documents to go to. So about 100 years after that was written, we have a couple of documents, Acts of John. There's something called Sibylline Oracles. And in those, we see sin lists. There's an economic sin list and a sexual sin list in these ancient Greek documents. And the word arsenokoitai is found in one of those lists. Guess what? It's not found on the sexual sin list. It's found on the economic sin list. So arsenokoitai is an economic sin, according to ancient documents near the time Paul wrote it. And so we can go and look, and one of the questions that we see that they kind of approach that today is they say, well, soft, that must be mean, you know, a submissive person, and then arsenokoitai, that must mean, so it must be the dominant and the submissive person in a gay relationship. So what do we call that today, top or bottom? Are you, so that's essentially how non-affirming theologians are teaching this today. Is they're saying this, well, therefore it must be the top and the bottom. It must be the submissive and it must be the aggressor. And so they're going down this strange path. We never saw this taught before. So one of my friends who's a theologian over in Norway, she was working on a research paper. So she said, I'm going to do the research to kind of find out if this is top and bottom. We would expect these two words to be paired closer together in other ancient Greek documents. So she went to see on all the documents from the time of Christ for 1,000 years later, every single time this word malakoi and arsenokoitai were paired within a 10-word distance. She found that it was paired within a 10-word distance one time, and that's in 1 Corinthians 6:9. So there is no supporting evidence, no supporting documentation, no looking at history and saying that you can say this means top and bottom. But that's basically kind of how the history of those two words, if that helps.
And the other thing about those two words in context is, okay, if you see that it's some kind of male exploitative male-male relationship, you can't even say men-men because it could have been a boy. So the most common male-male relationships in the Roman Empire in the first century were, the most common was master-slave. The second most common would have been man, lower-class male prostitute. And the third would have been, or equal to the second, would have been man, foreign-born, lower-class male. Of course, they're foreign, lower-class if they're foreign-born. Or foreign-born boy. It's different in the Greek empire, in the Greek culture, that the aristocracy allowed access to their aristocratic sons for sex because it was a mentoring program. So you can't even call that pederasty because they wouldn't have seen that as abusive. So first of all, you have to know what culture you're in, what time you're in, but it could have not been a consensual, equal status, romantic, loving, emotional, sexual relationships. Not even possible to consider that somebody would have seen it that way until the middle of the 20th century. So, so context and what kind of male-male relationships they're talking about.
One of the interesting things about this story is you might think, like, okay, clearly, why, like, this shouldn't have been translated in the first place. But if it did, why wasn't it fixed right away? Or it should have been fixed right away. But you talk through, and this is mentioned just kind of briefly in the documentary, but so the translation work starts happening in the 30s. The RSV 1946 version comes out, obviously, in 1946 with the word homosexuality. And then very quickly after that, a number of other Bible translations start using the word homosexuality, including arguably maybe one of the most popular translations ever, the New Living Translation, which is the one that Billy Graham used very, very frequently. And so all of a sudden, we have this wildfire of all these other biblical Bible translations that are starting to use this word homosexuality. And before it can get fixed, it's already out. And, you know, the sort of the Pandora box has already been opened. And so can you talk about that part of that aftermath and how this just sort of swept through all of these Bible translations?
So I'll give you the first part and I'll let Ed take, and you'll know where the second part is. I trust you. And so I was writing about Luther Weigel's life, the head of the translation team, and the dean at Yale Divinity. And I came across a story. I was trying to humanize him because whether you call it manipulation or what, I wanted you to feel what Ed and I felt when we were reading through his archives, that this is really a wonderful guy. I mean, he's really well respected. He's a wonderful guy. We didn't see any malice in this. So I'm trying to bring you along with me, like to get you in the mood and to get you to try to understand what a delightful man Luther Weigel is. So I'd read a story about his wife, and that when he was a dean of a school in Minnesota at the age of 28. He was a smart man. And so the person that ended up being his wife, you know, it was, she had been from a very aristocratic family, and she was going to school in the Northeast, and when money ran out during that period of time, she was forced to go to her local school in Minnesota. And so she was an older student at this college where he was the dean, and he waited for her to graduate, and then he wanted to date her. Yay on him, right? So he took
not
her...
Not too many youth pastors can say that.
No, not too many pastors. Good job. And so so he invited her to a winter ball, and he was walking down this wooden platform into the winter ball in, you know, snow season. There's slushy season and snow season. Mm-hmm. It was snow season.
There's some snow in Minnesota, okay. Yeah.
And so and he stepped on her boa, and he tripped her up, and she fell off this wooden platform in her silk dress and her boa into the mud. And she still married him. So I wanted to get the original story about this. And when I read the footnote, the original story was in this book called, oh, I can't remember the title. I can draw it for you. It had the word greatness. But anyway, it was a collection of essays written about Weigel from different people and some of his sermons. And it was collected by his son, another Weigel. And it was done in 76 after Weigel died. It was a tribute. So I wanted to, when I wanted to talk about the story, I didn't want to footnote a blog. I wanted to footnote the original source. So for 99 cents plus $3.99 on Amazon, I bought this book that no one on the planet besides me owns. And so I was, you know, I read this thing and I thought, I might as well read the rest of this 99 cents book. You know, don't waste 89 cents. So I read the rest of it, and I was reading through it, and there was an article or was an essay from the numbers guy at Thomas Nelson. And the numbers guy at Thomas Nelson was saying, numbers, we planned on doing this, we planned on doing this, we planned on doing this, we planned on doing these corrections. And then on one page, you know, right on this page, he said, the team got together in June of 1959, and they had been warned for months before, we're going to get together, we're going to go over the corrections and criticisms, we're going to resolve it, because the next time we go to print, we want to have addressed these criticisms from people. And they collected the 300 most salient criticisms, which I have a list of, and 1 Corinthians is not on it. And so they met, they came to an agreement in the beginning of September, and they signed a contract, I don't know contract, but a very strong agreement that we've agreed to these changes now, and for 10 years, we will not revisit this. So this was agreed to on October 1st, 1959. And I only found this out because I bought this 99-cent book. Mm. And so then I went back into the archives and looked for the paper trail. And indeed, they made a contract. And then so they agreed on October 1st, 1959, to make no more changes for 10 years. And Reverend David wrote his letter on October 22nd, 1959.
So I think let's trace one word for a second here. There's a Hebrew word, the Levitical passage, there's a Hebrew word in 1 Kings 14:24 that's called kedeshim. And today, if you look at a modern translation, it's probably going to say this is a male temple prostitute. And so God was saying, let's get rid of the male temple prostitutes in the land. You've let other religions move in and take over Israel, and now we have male temple prostitutes in the land. And its word is in Hebrew is kedeshim. And so to what's happened with that Hebrew word, kedeshim, got translated into the King James as sodomite. Okay, so male temple prostitute, you with me now? Male temple prostitute became sodomite. So when Dr. Kenneth Taylor was working on his translation of the Living Bible, he saw the word sodomite and he wrote homosexual. Mm-hmm. So do you see kind of like where when you follow when you trace a certain word like that, what happens? And so we found a lot of that all over. So as a result,
1946, the only Bible on the planet that has the word homosexual in it is the Revised Standard Version in 19. That was the New Testament because they hadn't yet completed the Old Testament, which came out in 1952. And so these translations that were being done in the 60s were the most populous English translations, which are the Living Bible, the New American Standard Bible, and the most populous, the New International Version, okay, which came out in 1978. So they were all working on their translations in the 60s in order to publish in the 70s. Okay, so you've got these three translations going through the 60s, but what did the RSV just do that Kathy showed us? They signed a 10-year contract in 1959 that we're not going to do anything or make any changes for the next 10 years. So then we went to the translation notes and archives of those translations, and actually a few more than that. Three, by the way, seven translation notes that we've been through between the two of us, three of the ones that I went to said, you're the first person to ever ask to look at these archives at all for any reason. That made me want to cry. Nobody cared enough about us to actually check this out, which I thought was the most important question of our modern church today is how did the word homosexual end up in the Bible? Mm. But anyway, I digress. So we go back to this. We've got in the 1960s, these three major English translations, NIV, TLB, and NASB are being translated. So we went to those translation notes, and what did we find there? That they actually used the RSV as one of their books that they were using, the only book on their entire table, because they showed us all the books that they were using when they were doing the translation. It's the only book in their entire category or catalog that was used that had the word homosexual in it. And they were like, well, they did the work. Why do we have to? They said homosexual belongs there. Why do we have to? And so they plopped it into their translations without looking back. And when we look at the Living Bible, remember I told you they go from Kedeshim to Sodomite to homosexual, right? That was in the 60s. Kenneth Taylor's the one who saw Sodomite in his King James Version. That's the same thing as homosexual, right? Right? So he plopped it in and ended up putting it in six locations. So we had the word homosexual in one verse, 1946, and then in the 60s we had it in six verses because of sloppy scholarship.
And as you alluded to, it was the number, until March 2015, the Living Bible was the number one Bible. It was a version of it was the Bible that I was given when I became a Christian, the Way Bible. And that was the one that was handed out at the Billy Graham rallies. And so here, as Ed says, it goes from one place to six places. And then, not too long after that, the AIDS crisis breaks out. And we can then go to for evidence in Romans 1 that the due penalty of this homosexual behavior is AIDS. I mean, that's how people make the leap.
This episode of A People's Theology is brought to you by United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. Are you considering exploring your faith more deeply? Or are you called to ministry, but haven't found a seminary that is quite right for you? When you come to United, you join a community that is intentionally open, socially aware, and theologically adventurous. United's passion is equipping leaders to make real, lasting change in the world through their many different degree programs. Whether your vocation is in faith leadership, nonprofit leadership, academia, the arts, activism, or social entrepreneurship. And the best news is you don't have to uproot your life to attend seminary. United offers maximum flexibility to fit your schedule. Attend on campus or online, part-time or full-time. Their leading distance learning technology allows students to be active in the classroom and engaged with the United community. Want to learn more? Visit unitedseminary.edu/apeoplestheology or click the link in the episode description and receive a $1,000 scholarship when you apply and are admitted. United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities, training leaders to dismantle systems of oppression, care for the spiritual needs of a multi-faith world, and push the boundaries of theology.
So that's all happening in the 70s and 80s with a lot of these translations coming up and becoming really popular. What's happening now when it comes to Bible translations? I think if I remember right in the documentary, there's a mention that there are some translations now that are moving away from using the word homosexuality. What are some of those translations? And is there any work to correct all of these mistakes?
Good question. I'm going to start off real quickly and then give it to Kathy because she's got a lot of good information on this one. But one of the things that we see in that we were contacted by the Norwegian translation team who are now working on their new Bible. They heard of our work and they said, hey, I need to talk to you before we make another mistake. Yeah. And so it's good that they're starting to look at that, starting to question it. But if you look since 1378, when we have the first English Bible, which is the Wycliffe Bible, we have since then have 450 English translations. So obviously not everybody agreed, right? So there have been different translations that have come throughout the years. And so we've seen this word change over time. What's going on now? It's interesting because I got a text message from Dr. Gagnon the other day, and he said, well, absolutely, he's the most non-affirming theologian on the planet. Okay, he considers himself the leader of the non-affirming theologians. So he said, of course, homosexual is not the proper translation of these two Greek words. Of course it's not. And so he goes in to explain what he's going to be saying. But at the end of the day, we're seeing some of the more conservative translations saying man with man or male with male. And so they don't kind of get in there very well. But we see people starting to question this. You have to remember, the Bible is a huge book, right? So it would require a lot of disciplines, and I'm talking about psychology, science, archaeology, et cetera, to be able to translate an entire Bible. So you need to integrate people that are specialists in those areas. And when I was a seminary student, we were required to integrate various disciplines, and we study a passage. We better, if there's new archaeological dig and it's going to shed light on this particular passage, you better do it or you didn't do your work. Mm-hmm. Commentaries might include it. Commentaries might not. But this is the one section, the one topic where I see theologians don't integrate other disciplines into the conversation.
Mm. So the new Revised Standard Version, little u, little e, updated edition, which came out not this past spring, but the one before, they've now translated that verse to say men who engage or participate in illicit sex, which causes you at least to stop and to say, what is illicit sex? To at least have a conversation about what illicit sex is. And it also doesn't limit it to same-sex attracted people, because as we, you know, maybe not in this room, I know there are heterosexual men that are doing illicit sex.
Some of them even might become president.
Yes, some of them have been president. Oh, what? Wow, you're there. And so what we are hoping is that we raise enough questions in conversations with people and enough kinds of people, so not just scholars, not just Christians that are attending churches, but as I said, I love the parents of gay with gay kids. Raise enough questions for people to say, maybe this is wrong, because that's where we start. It's just so surprising to me that no one said before, like, how did they do this? I know that at the core, I popularized the what happened in 1946, and then Ed and Rocky came on board, and you would never have heard 3 or 4 years ago, people never would have said as a common statement, do you know that that word was not in the Bible until 1946? That was not a statement that was being said. So at least we've done that much. But I think the combination of the movie and the book and people having these conversations are going to start more conversations that this is not a correct translation. So I don't know if we'll directly affect translations, because the worst one is the ESV, which is the most popular amongst conservative evangelical Christians. Mm-hmm. And that says, men who have sex with men, footnote, the passive and dominant partners in a consensual homosexual relationship. And now, as I said before, there was no consensual male-male relationships in the first century. Master-slave, man-prostitute, man-lower-class foreign-born boy. Those are not consensual male relationships. There's power associated with them. So that is a horrible translation. But the only thing about the ESV that's good is it says that the thing that's banned is homosexuality, men with men. So lesbians, you're good. Oh. No, you go ahead.
Go ahead.
And the message is a good one. Eugene Peterson, a lot of information about him the last several years before he died. But it's people that use and abuse sex, people that use and abuse others. That's a wonderful translation. Don't treat someone else as if they're less important than you are.
one of the thoughts as I was watching the movie and also hearing you talk right now is thinking through, like, what are the conservative arguments from a conservative scholar or, you know, theologian that would concede, okay, the word should not be, these words should not be translated to homosexuality, but their argument would be, but the principle still is there, that homosexuality is a sin. I can hear that argument being made. I'm curious, like, what your response to that would be. Is that the Bible still teaches that homosexuality is a sin, even if those words shouldn't have been translated to homosexuality?
Yes, there's a lot of internalized homophobia in that particular group of people.
Stop.
So one thing I think I would say in looking at that is this particular conversation, and Kathy could very well attest to this, over the past three decades, the goalpost keeps on moving. So first of all, we're talking about, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, and shame on, you know, God hates you homosexuals so bad that he destroyed an entire city because of it. And then when you actually parse that particular passage and you show and you say, this was about a potential rape that never took place, but a rape from straight people wanting to sodomize the people to basically put fear into their hearts and say, hey, we're on top, because patriarchy, that's what patriarchy does. I'm on top, you're on bottom, so you have to submit to me. That's what it's all about, and that's how it's been for thousands of years. And so when we take it and we go to Genesis 19 and talk about Sodom and Gomorrah, and we kind of say, no, that's not really how it's been looked at. And also, what is Genesis? It's an Old Testament book, so it's a Jewish book written by Jewish people to give to Jewish people, for Jewish people, right? So maybe we should talk to Jewish people if we want to really find out what's going on in Genesis.
Good idea.
And when we do, we find out that there was no... The word sodomite, as we think of a homosexual in certain circles, was never intended by the Jewish people. So if we look at, for the last couple of thousand years, or the last 3,000 years of Jewish history, they never used that passage as a clobber passage. Never, never. Not until the Christians came along in the 5th century and changed it. Another story. The word sodomizing didn't come about until the 9th century, when a Catholic pope was kind of saying, hey, we need a word to kind of describe what we see some of these priests doing. And so that's how they came up with the word, because they didn't have a word for it. So that being said, we kind of see, like, we need to, like Kathy says, we need to untangle the mess. There's just a big mess out there of understanding, and kind of to kind of go from there.
Yep. So the way I would argue with people is, yes, there is a ban on abusive male-male relationships. Don't abuse your household staff, your enslaved people. Don't abuse foreign-born men or boys because they're lower class than you. And if you're doing that, don't do that. Those things hold. Don't abuse other people sexually for your own pleasure, out of your own power and privilege that gives you the right in the Roman Empire to have those sorts of male-male relationships. So in Corinthians, when Paul is saying, we don't know the question that was asked of him that he's responding to, but I can hear him saying, wait a minute, they do that, like, such for some of you, right? That's a verse used against gay people. But hey, wait a minute, you used to do that when you were in that other empire. You used to behave that way in the Roman Empire. It was okay to have male-male, dominant, abusive, coercive sex. That's okay out in that kingdom, but you're in a new kingdom now. You're in a kingdom where we're all supposed to be equal. We're all supposed to respect each other equally. I mean, there's still going to be enslaved people, but you don't use and abuse other people. That was out in that kingdom. Such were some of you. You used to be in that kingdom. Now you're in this kingdom, and this is how we do it. We're all equal in this kingdom. So it takes a little bit of expression. I was hiking the other day, and if you follow me on Facebook, I put a post up that a woman, you know, she's been thinking I've been a wonderful person for months. You know, oh, isn't she cheerful? Look at her with her dog all the time. Like, isn't she a nice person? So we finally, she caught up to me one day, because I was going over some notes. I was walking slowly, and she caught up to me, and she talked, and she said, are you retired? No. What do you do? I'm a writer, educator, researcher. What do you do? And I tell her, and the first question was, well, what do you do with Romans? And it was nasty. What do you do with Romans 1? And I said, well, to answer that, I'm going to have to give you context So I start talking about what male, and I made it as brief as I could, male, sex looked like in the first century. And she said, I don't want to hear about that. I want you to talk about what's in the Bible. People, I think it's important that people know what the context is. Yeah. I'm so big on, I say patriarchy, penetration, procreation, and context all the time. I want people to question what the context is. Because, yes, those relationships were inappropriate. I agree with Paul.
So, seeing that the conversation has been changing and the goalpost has been moving over time, so what we'll see is they'll come up with another verse. Well, what about this verse? And then they'll take a certain verse and, like, twist it into something it's never intended to be to use it as a clobber passage. And you're kind of like, wow, this is just really crazy. And so one of the things I started doing when I was researching and kind of digging in is I would look at these long YouTube videos by some, and I wanted to really face-to-face with these non-affirming theologians. And so what I started realizing was I started categorizing things. I had categories that were scripturally based, categories that were an opinion based, and then categories that just, they were just using like weird science or something over here. And I was so surprised by how much of it was opinion and conjecture, not based upon anything scripture. And they would just make stuff up. So they have created a narrative about LGBT people over the last several decades that was not true. But because it's been preached from pulpits, people think it's true. So we're trying to re-educate people on facts and truth about LGBT people.
What's up, a People's Theology listeners? I would love for you to support the podcast. There are a few ways you can do that. First, sharing the podcast to others who you think would also enjoy it and find it helpful is a great way to support the podcast. It's like evangelism, but for something actually good. I really think the ideas explored on this podcast matter, and I believe they are worth sharing with others. Second, if you're not totally depraved and use Apple Podcasts like me, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and review. It might not seem like much, but every rating and review helps the podcast tremendously in a world more predestined by algorithms than by God. Third, please support my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Meniga. It's like tithing, but for something actually good. This podcast takes a lot of time and energy to make, so supporting my work through Patreon is a great way to make sure this podcast can continue to be made. With all that said, please enjoy more inspiring and liberating theology.
So I think this correction that should be made is important, to go back to how you've been talking about how it should be translated. I think that's important. But this is bringing up like a larger issue. And I think this issue around homosexuality is a larger issue for a lot of people where and this happened in your conversation. I think it was with Rocky's father where he even brought up, well, if homosexuality isn't a sin and the Bible doesn't teach that, then how can I trust that the world was made in 6 literal days or whatever, right? So this is a larger issue around biblical inerrancy for them. And I'm wondering at some point, I think for those of us that are on the side of Christianity that we're on, for us to recognize, okay, there could be this in this translation error that happened, but I do think we may have to say, you know what, the Bible may be with error. Like we don't have to be inerrantist when it comes to the Bible, and we can still love the Bible even if we're not inerrantist, right? And so that I think is another step, and that to me is like the broader issue for a lot of these folks is they want to not concede to the inerrancy part. And so I'm curious, like how you navigate that with maybe some of these more conservative people that you're working with, is that you might have to just say, you know what, I don't believe the Bible is without error, and that's something that's really important for us to like accept.
Okay, we have to keep in mind that the Bible is a joint venture between a perfect and holy divine God and imperfect humans. And if we're going to put it in the hands of these imperfect humans to translate to various languages and to send over the last 2,000 years, we're going to have a few problems here and there, right? And so we've had certain inaccuracies in the past. If you look at any old art in the medieval times, you'll see Moses has horns. And whether it's a sculpture, whether it's a painting, you have Moses with horns. Kathy didn't know this. We were and I was looking at it, and she says, why does he have horns? And because she had never seen it before, and I just explained, because in the Latin Vulgate, it was the halo, so to speak, over his head. It's not really halo, but the holiness coming out. They used the wrong word. Just a Jerome who translated it used the word horns instead of like holiness coming out or something like that. So that's why they always put horns on Moses in old art. So we have had mistakes in it in the past, but we have to remember, if God is perfect and holy and he has communicated to us and we are entrusted with pursuing that communication throughout the decades and the centuries and the millennial, then we're going to have some issues there, and we need to kind of tread humbly in that particular conversation. So I think that it's important that we realize the limitations that are there. And I think when I have conversations with conservative people, what I want to remind them is, that book in your hand is not a divine-inspired book. It's a translation that is in your hands. It's an English translation at that, right? And so to kind of let them know, and people are having a hard time because when they hear inerrancy, they think that this English Bible on their coffee table at home plopped down from heaven somehow. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have a clear and accurate understanding of it. So I like to talk to people and show them some things where we have to kind of look at this. Now, and another thing we have to remember, Rocky's dad, in that particular example that you gave, he did not go to seminary, so he never was able to be educated in Greek and Hebrew. He did not study the Bible from a theological standpoint in a seminary setting. And so he doesn't know that certain books of the Bible are poetry, other books are a little bit of history, and then we have some law, we have different types of books in there. And so if you look at it as a historical document in a place that it was not intended, you're going to walk away with something that's not very accurate. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we have today. And a lot of our pastors are in that position where they haven't gone to seminary, they haven't studied, they don't understand that this is the way the Bible was written, and they're looking at it as a literal thing of something in history, and that's not necessarily going to get us to an accurate understanding.
And so we just have different ways. This is why this is good. We have different ways of approaching things. So when I look at the book of Genesis, or when I look at Genesis 1 and 2, I'm not looking at science and history. I'm looking at, you know, this is not a penis-vagina story. This is a story about how much, instead of all these gods, Sumerian, Babylonian, Mesopotamian gods, got together and sometimes in violence created this land and created people, there was one God, one holy God that always existed from all time. He created the cosmos. He filled the planets. He created people. He did this because he loves us. So this is what they were trying to tell with that story. They're not trying to say one man, one woman. And when we get to Leviticus, we're talking about moral codes for the area that were very common. Lots of different ways to look at Leviticus. When we're looking at Romans, we're looking at almost Paul's political commentary on what's going on in Rome at the time. The two emperors that were completely out of control around Paul's time are Caligula. I've seen the movie. And Nero, and no, he didn't fiddle while Rome was burning. That was created in the 14th century. That didn't happen. But these two emperors were completely out of control, and they were completely out of control because they worshipped idols. They did not worship Yahweh. So this is a Jewish thought that says, if you do not worship the one true God, idolatry leads to all of this stuff. Those sinless, idolatry leads to all of this stuff. And again, Corinthians, it's about don't treat other people that way. So when I talk to people, I try to talk about what is the overarching message that you're supposed to get from the Bible. God created the world. He created us because he loves us. He put his image in every single one of us, and he wants us to treat other people fairly and equally. And my interpretations fit into that very short idea of what the Bible is, and I refuse to have these little conversations about verses taken out of context with people that don't want to hear about context. Mm. And then when she got back to the car, she was like, I'm just going to tell you this. I love you. Well, your face ain't saying it, babe. Kathy, I love you, and I'm going to pray for you because the end time is here, and you need to know God. And I'm like, okay, have a nice day.
Oftentimes I hear folks, you know, I grew up in the conservative world as well, and a lot of times they would accuse us of hating the Bible. And I would imagine you have heard that, especially with the work that you've done. But when I hear you both talk, I can hear you love the Bible. And so I'm really curious, how has this extensive research into this mistranslation made you love the Bible more?
I have been forced to look at overarching messages. And as a straight evangelical Christian, and also a person with a fairly good scientific mind, I have wondered over the past years in the past how an educated person that values academics can love the Bible, because there's so much in there that doesn't hold into our modern world. It doesn't translate. And when I had to then grapple with these verses and what they mean, I was forced into exactly what Ed was saying, looking at the genre that each of these books is written in, and then from a Jewish point of view, what were these Hebrew authors, because none of them were Christian, right? What were these Hebrew authors trying to tell us about God and the relationship with God? And sometimes some of my friends, and even Netto and I have had this conversation. She said, when you all know all of this stuff, how can you sometimes still be a Christian? Mm. Because I can now see the beauty of what the real core message of the sacred book is. And that guy, Jesus, he is worth following. Mm. Because he tried to come and say, you know, you Jewish people, you've kind of bastardized it in some ways. Look at me. I'm doing what the Father wants me to do. I like that guy. Mm-hmm. And I value the Bible, mm-hmm. but I can read it in context.
Mm-hmm. The late Rachel Held Evans often had this great line that would where she said, the story of Jesus is a story I'm willing to risk. Yes.
Yep. In my situation, I think a lot of us in the room can probably understand. For many years in the church, people thought we were straight because you can't necessarily tell by looking at someone right off the bat whether they're gay or straight. and then it came to the point of the coming out and the rejection from church and the rejection from leadership if we're in a church or even membership or whatever the case may be. And then we go through this whole process. And so I think during that kind of rejection process, for a lot of us, it's hard to sometimes go to a church, to be around Christians, to sing worship songs in a church. And it might be a difficult time for that. And then for me, I was like, I went through reading the Bible every single day and spending time every single day to I can't open it today. I just can't today. And I went through this time period. And you have to remember, my mom used to laugh because when I was a kid, she gave me a Bible for my birthday, and that was the best birthday gift ever. And I started reading it. I was in second grade, and I was so excited. I just wanted to read all of it and learn everything I possibly could. And so I've always had a heart for Scripture, a heart for the Bible, and it's interesting. Probably I could argue that I might love Scripture more than a lot of these non-affirming mm-hmm, theologians. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I love it so much that I'm willing to be sure we're going to be accurate with it mm-hmm. in the understanding. And so just going through that time, and then I can remember there's a friend of mine. He's here at the conference. He's the tallest guy in the whole place. He's 6'8", Sandy. And so he had gone through some similar things, and I had gone through some similar things. And so we were talking on the phone one day, and we had both kind of said, I don't want to read the Bible for a while, and went back into, I want to go back and read it now because I now realize God loves me, and I want to go back to the Bible. And so it was so interesting because we were sharing what we were learning and calling, what do you think about this? And I realized, as much as I loved the Bible before, I was reading it in black and white. Mm. And now that I see God's perspective and that his box is bigger than the box I was putting him in, I'm reading it in color.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
We do have time for maybe one question. And so if there's any audience, yeah, we're getting close to time. But if we have any questions, we've got one back here. Here, talk on the mic and let's hear what you have to say.
Thanks. So, hi, my name is Charisse. So if you were involved in a church that you loved but did not have this point of view, I've been told I can no longer be a leader, but I can come and I can give my money. But so how do you broach the subject without being defensive or argumentative, or what would be the best way to bring it to leadership?
Well, as of now, the quickest tool you've got, but it's not going to be forever, the documentary is great. Mm. 1946 is a great opener. I cannot tell you how many emails and messages and direct messages I'm getting of people saying, and actually, I won't say the name of the church, but a friend told me that a very prominent church in this country, they got their staff together and they watched it. And I got the text message from one pastor to another of, we were so impressed with the three different stories of Rocky, Ed, and Kathy, because we represent different things in the story, right? And that they are now having conversations that maybe this has been mistranslated. and it's such an easy tool. It will be generally streamed at some point or available, but an hour and 28-minute tool that somebody can watch without anyone else knowing they're watching it is very convincing. And then I think when my book comes out, the support statement for that is another thing. And so I think just getting thoughtful, non-combative, academic information into the hands of someone and saying, please just consider reading this. Can we have a conversation? Hey, invite them to coffee. They've been inviting gay people. They've been inviting gay people to coffee for decades.
I would say, just to keep in mind, you probably have two major directions you can go. You can stay or you can go, right? You can stay in that church and stick it out and help them learn and help the process. Or you can say, I'm going to go to an affirming church. And the way you answer that question is, what is going to be good for you? Because if you're going to stay and it's going to be harmful to you, that might not be a good idea. If you're going to stay because you want to help those people walk through and you've got some kind of a support somewhere else where you can make it through, that might be the way to go.
We actually do have time for one more before we get to the screening, but got one back here.
Hi, my name is Jess, and I don't actually have a question. I just wanted to say thank you, Kathy. I'm going to try to do it quick and without crying. It was 2 years ago that I was walking up and down the beach in Florida, and I listened to like all 5 hours of your YouTube lecture all at one time. And I have 6 children, and I had been married at the time to a man for over 20 years. And I listened to what you said, and I said, oh my God, if this is true, what does this mean about my life and the choices that I've made? And 2 years later, I'm in love with this woman. And I am alive, and I am free, and I don't hate who I am. And I know that I was created this way for a purpose by a loving God. So thank you.
I can't think of a better way to end. Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you so much, Kathy. Thank you so much, Ed. Let's give Kathy and Ed another round of applause.
You can get connected with Kathy and Ed and their work in the links in the episode description. Thank you again for listening to another episode of A People's Theology. If you liked what you heard, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and review. Also, please support the podcast at my Patreon at patreon.com/MasonMeniga. And remember, friends, go and be the theology to the world that inspires and liberates.